The waves crash against the beach, echoing through the seas of people hoping for better, for brighter, for more. Many hands stained with the memories of ink and blood, hoping this was safe, this was free. Some harbor the dark thoughts of extortion and sin, to pray in the morning and kill in the evening. One had the cross, the other the gun. The Black Hand Society had dominion of the underground, and their grasp was wide. As high as they would rise, it was just as far down a fall. Lit candles burned the brightest at night, and Frank Oldfield and Francis Demio were about to stride out into the dusk.
I didn't see you there.
It all started early this morning.
From hunting ghosts to Bigfoot, UFOs, cryptids, true crime, paranormal, and more.
I've always wanted to see a UFO.
Oh, I was researching for your entertainment.
That's Bigfoot's guy.
He basically wrote the book on modern culture.
We aren't really comedians.
What if Buddha did cocaine?
The Addams Family on meth.
This is the Black Cat Report. See you on the other side.
Welcome to the Black Cat Report in episode 90. I'm Joey, and with me is... Wait. Where's Gil? Did he get kidnapped?
I'm right here, Joey.
Oh, there he is. Oh, thank God. I thought they kidnapped you.
I was in disguise.
Okay.
That was in disguise.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I thought they got you.
Not this time.
Especially since that last email. Message we got.
No. Check my mailbox. Still standing strong. Still... falling over on a regular basis.
Good. Okay, good. It's good to see you. Good. Thank you for being not kidnapped, Gil. I don't know if I could have done this without you, honestly.
I tried. You know, I woke up every day and I tried my best.
And you succeeded.
Yes.
You succeeded.
Yep.
Well, anyways, today we're going to finish up our series on the Black Hand Society and Frank Oldfield. And also, just recently found out that I am related to the people in the Black Hand Society. Which
this just
my
keeps
mother
getting
told
deeper.
Me.
It just keeps getting fucking deeper.
My great-grandfather was an orphan on the streets of Naples, Italy, and made his way to Sicily and joined the street gangs there, which, as we know, is kind of where the Black Hand Society people came from, and the idea of the Black Hand extortion. He then came to the United States and was part of a gambling ring for the mafia running numbers. He had a family and then randomly disappeared to Mexico. And no one knows what happened to him after that.
Hell yeah.
That is part of my family. Just found that out for my mom the other day when I talked to her about this.
It's so awesome, so, man.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I make a quick announcement here, Joey?
You can? Yes.
Awesome. So, if it's written in these stars before the eclipse happens, there is a slight chance, and I don't know if you guys have saw this on our Instagram. If not, well, here's the update. There's a very, very, very slight chance, which is actually a pretty good chance, that Black Cat Report, F-bombs and all, is going to be airing on radio stations internationally, probably come April. Again, fingers crossed that it happens, but we are like 99% of the way there. Now, if this happens, we're going to be on FM and AM radio stations in Detroit, Tampa Bay, Southwest Florida, Charlotte, North Carolina, the UK, and Northern Ireland.
Literally everywhere.
Yeah.
That I know of. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anywhere that we can travel and speak English, you know, pretty much. But stoked as fuck. So fingers crossed, be on the lookout for that. And I know we got some other news here, Joey. We got one more thing. We have.
What's the other news?
We have episode 3 of Beer,
We Do.
Booze, Boogeymen. It's coming out on, let's see,
April 6th.
That's right. So yeah, next episode of Beer, Booze, Boogeyman is going to be April 6th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 6:30 p.m. Central, and what would that be, 4:30 p.m. for West Coast, I believe? Something like
Pacific,
that.
Yep.
Y'all know. Anyways, the East Coast is the only one that matters. So 7:30 p.m. on the
it's
East
true.
Coast. And
don't
for all
the
of our friends
for
and
nothing.
Family. Yeah, that's right. It's the East Coast. But yeah. So next episode of Beer, Booze, Boogeyman is going to be 7:30 p.m. East Coast time on Saturday, April 6th. It is going to be haunted electronics, haunted AI, fears of the AI future, anything like that. Call in. Again, you know, What has your Alexa been up to while you're not at home? Have you been catching weird shit on camera? We want to know. Send those files to us. Send those videos to us. Give us your social security number and your mother's maiden name. We need this information.
Perfect. Yep. Well, yeah. My. It has been a ride.
Yes.
Last episode, we took a look at the Black Hand Society and their new leader, Samuel Lima. Our new friend, Sam. He was extorting people with his Black Hand extortion letters of wealth or death. He built a nice-sized criminal empire in Ohio, Gil's home state, and was living his best life. Well, I guess he was technically living off of other people's best lives.
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. Lima had taken over from the pasta-loving, wine-drinking, womanizing Salvatore Arrigo, who had grown old, and as I learned last episode, he was not put out to pasture. He just retired.
I have a correction on that. I have a correction on my correction. You were 100% right in your usage of that.
Boom!
I also didn't include that in the show. I cut that part out. But I do want to tell you, straight to your face digitally, you totally won. You're like, putting that in the calendar, anniversary. No, you were 100% yeah. right. I had never heard it used in that way. I had heard it used in the old country way of saying it, like in the old, like, living out in the sticks. We're being put out to pasture meant like a shotgun to the head. And so I was like, God damn.
Which yeah, or you were sending old Bessie to the farm, you know?
Yeah. But like in the mob, using a phrase like being put out to pasture makes sense because
murdering
it's
somebody.
Just like, yeah, they're straight up being like, we ain't gonna let you retire. Shotgun to the back of the fucking head, you know? But yeah. But you were 100% right. That is a usage of it. The colloquial expression. I need to call that out.
Well, Frank Oldfield was not gonna let them retire either. So he would never. Well, it was Sam Lima's time.
Okay.
We ended this episode with Lima's next target, John Amacon, getting pissed off that Lima was trying to extort him. And in he strode into the office of Frank Oldfield and slammed those letters on Frank's desk. Frank was ready, and everything he had done in his life had led him to this. As we last left our story, John Amacon was in Frank's office, right? So describing the letters and the threats he had received from the Black Hand Society. Frank listened intently as John Amacon tried to explain in broken English, so he was Italian, he's speaking broken English, saying, I will testify in court against the criminals. It is my duty as an American citizen. Frank finally had something he could go on, and it had been about a year since the Bellefontaine, Ohio murder. And Frank, not known as a patient man, was getting fed up being stymied at every freaking turn. Well, it was about time Frank made his moves, right? He now had a witness who would testify in court. He had letters tying the Black Hand Society to the crime, and he also finally had a suspect, Samuel Lima, who John Amacon thought must be the perpetrator, right?
Yeah.
So the reason he kind of knew he must be the perpetrator is he saw him and one of his goons breaking into his house because they had put dynamite, remember, on his porch in his home. And so he saw him, and he also was both in the fruit business, so they kind of knew of each other. And he kind of heard some rumblings that his friends were getting letters and that people he knew were getting letters. So he started being like, I think it's this guy.
Yeah.
And Frank was like, well, it's time to start gathering information on Samuel Lima. So, as I want to say, I know we've made jokes about Frank being a master of disguise and a lawman to the T. In the last episode, the first episode, we made jokes about him being a master of disguise, right?
Yeah.
Because he was not a master of disguise.
He was not anything but.
Yeah. Well, what he lacked in being a master disguise, he actually was great at making friends in high places and low places, right?
Okay.
So this dude was great. Like, he's basically putting all his political things that he did in his past to good use now.
Okay.
So Frank kept close contact with the criminals he put away, which is kind of a funny thing to say, right? So everybody he put in jail, he still kept close contact with. He even became friendly with about like 75% of the people he put in jail. Some of the criminals in jail would even write Frank's wife and kids and, you know, good, nice letters of like, hey, hope you guys are doing well. We just want you to basically be okay. And, you know, we're not mad at Frank for putting us in jail. Really weird that that's happened, but that's how well he was liked. That's how well he was liked.
Okay, so Frank... Frank was a people person.
Weirdly, he became a people person, I feel like. Even when he was a politician, he still rubbed some people the wrong way. But he, for some reason, with other people, with like random people, he was so good at getting to know people and like getting down to like, what do they say, like brass tacks with people and getting to know them. One of the reasons he was so well liked by a lot of the prisoners, because the people he would put away basically was usually a lot of husbands.
Yeah.
He would look after the wives and the children of those husbands and pretty much take them out for dinner, making sure they would want for nothing.
Was he doing what postmen are notorious for doing?
I'm not saying that he was schmoozing the wives of the criminals he put in jail.
He was making sure the bed stayed warm. I got you. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
The bed was very hot when he was making sure it stayed warm.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of that, he would schmooze up the ladder too. And he would make a lot of friends in high places, just like he did when he was a politician in Maryland, right?
Yeah.
So it was really amazing to see just the things that were put in place in his life that helped him in this investigation. Well, I want to be fair and say that his dad put in place to get him where he was.
Yeah.
Not really that he did any of these things because he's a child of trust funds. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Frank especially got close with each of the major journalists of the papers in Ohio. Super essential to help make this case and that he could catch his white whale, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in February of 1909, Frank started gathering everything he could find on the Lima brothers, Sam and Sebastian.
Did you just say the white whale line in relation to Rise of the Ronin and that boss that kept kicking our ass yesterday who just kept saying, "The Japan is my white whale"?
Very subtle in there.
Yeah.
I realized it after I wrote it, by the way.
Pretty sure we heard that line a good 37 times yesterday.
I think that's why it got stuck in my head as I was writing this. Well, in getting all the information he could on the Lima brothers, he called the Italian consulate in Cincinnati to get any records of jail time, wrongdoing, and he even got a copy of Sebastian Lima's naturalization certificate to come to the United States.
I can't read a goddamn thing on this.
Which is so which is funny you say that because he wrote it himself. One of the lines that I wanted to mention in it, because I thought it was very indicative of the time period and what was valued. So one of the lines in the naturalization certificate is, in quotations, "I arrived at the port of Boston in the state of Massachusetts on or about the 14th day of October, 1900. I am not an anarchist. Mm-hmm. I am not a polygamist, nor a believer in the practice of polygamy. And it is my intention of good faith to become a citizen of the United States of America and to permanently reside therein." So, sorry, Gil, technically you couldn't become a U.S. citizen if you immigrated here.
I already lied when I filled out for my passport, so.
There you go.
Do
they still have the
in.
Anarchism thing in there?
They do. They literally
really?
Do. Yeah,
I didn't know it was still in there.
No, those things kind of stick out to people like me. And I was just like, political freedom. Kind of weird that I'm not allowed to have that here, but whatever. But anyways.
Or a polygamist? Was that it? That probably wasn't in there.
I don't remember the polygamist thing, but I do specifically remember the anarchist thing. And I was just like, what?
Yeah, that's a weird thing to put in there now.
Yeah, it's not legal.
No, Nick, not. I imagine that they honestly just have not gone back to change any of these things.
Yeah.
But they should. They should. I mean, like, a little touch up on some of these, like, old documents, those old rules, might be a good thing. Well, the workload of this case was going to be tremendous, right? So many letters, so many documents. So Frank handpicked a few other inspectors to help with the load. To give you an idea of the scope of the job of an inspector, in 1909, there were about 100 postal inspectors in the United States.
Damn.
Right?
Damn.
That's not many.
No.
That's like none at all.
That's barely two per state. And like when you think about like a city like, well, you think about cities like New York, Boston, let's see, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Toledo at the time, because Toledo used to be a large city. Columbus, Cincinnati, that could be like maybe like three per major ass city like that? That is not enough.
No, not enough. Well, they ended up having 280,000 cases to sift through for those 100 postal inspectors, right?
Yeah.
They actually created a filing system.
Yeah, I bet.
Which was like A through D, of course, you know, yeah. A through D listed on as important, right? So A was important. D was like somebody painted a mailbox of a...
somebody of painted... yeah. Somebody painted a Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah. Stupid stuff like that. Well, it was also noted in the book, big time, that literally all Frank Oldfield did was just sift through it. And anything after A, he would just throw to the next guy. So B through D, he was like, eh, they can deal with it. He wouldn't even look at it. It could be something that turned out big. He just didn't give a fuck. He didn't care.
Yeah.
He's like, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going through the big ones.
Mm.
And yeah, so he didn't. He wanted to be the highest ranking without doing all the work, you know, so it's kind of part of it.
It's chasing clout.
Right. I also found out that just before the Civil War, so about 1860, there were only 16 inspectors for the whole of the United States.
Damn.
That's how quickly they grew quickly. And last year, just last year, 2023, there are only 1,250 inspectors.
Damn.
There's not that many comparatively to like anything else, right? So it's a weird thing because there's so much mail. You know, and probably I would say maybe a little less mail goes through the U.S. Postal Service than it used to.
Yeah.
Because emails and stuff like that. But still, 1,200 inspectors for what, 400 or 500 million people?
That actually does explain why my MUFON membership journal is generally about a week late.
Yes.
I think we need to petition the government to get this changed. Not for you, but for my MUFON membership journal.
Exactly. You need that quicker.
I pay good money for that periodical.
Well, besides the nerdiness of Gil showing right here, the workload was staggering to think about. Like, thinking about that, that's like 280,000 for 100 people. That's 2,800.
That's an envelope right there.
Yeah, literally. And honestly, they probably just didn't even look at most half of the cases because they just didn't care. You know, it's too much. It's that point of like, you know, the NYPD in the 60s and 70s, there's just too many murder cases coming across their desk that they're just, you get to a point where it doesn't matter. You just let it go because you're like, there's just too much. Well, so he recruited Edward Hutches, who was an inspector in the south of Columbus.
I only inspect Hutches.
Yes. Only Hutches that have mail in them. It's very specific inspector. Well, and George Pate. There's no accent over the E.
I only inspect pad thai.
He was an inspector from Cincinnati. And Raleigh Hosford.
I only inspect Hosfords. I need three men with three unique sets of skills.
O'Reilly was another inspector from Cincinnati, which is weird to think that there was two out of the 100. There was two in Cincinnati. It seems like Ohio was a very big, double sin.
Sin City.
It just seems like there was a lot of goings on in Ohio at this moment, especially with the postal inspection service. I do feel like it was a big hub for it because of the railroads actually going through.
Well, okay, so backtrack on geographic history here. Cincinnati sits on the Ohio River, right? It's one of the largest, I think it is the largest city, at least on Ohio side, but like on the Ohio River, when you had not more than what, 50, 60 years earlier, the Civil War going on, Ohio was sitting safely in the Union, right? And it's that the Ohio River line, which connects, so it not only goes from, you know, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, the states like kind of on the far western side of the eastern states, you have the connection to the Ohio River. That Ohio River connection, which goes through Cincinnati, also goes straight into the Mississippi River and expands everything out to the west, expands things out to the ports, expands things out to the Gulf. So you had a long, multi-hundred-year-long history of river boats and river transportation being a major, major hub for development for this country, on an industrial level, And on just a transportation level, it was so fucking huge. And Cincinnati played a major role in that. So Cincinnati used to be one of the biggest fucking hubs for 2/3 of the goddamn country. If you wanted to go to it, you were going through Cincinnati, right? So if you were coming from New York and you were trying to go southwest, basically, you would hit the Ohio River, flow along the Ohio River, cut along the bottom, and, like, you had to go through Cincinnati, or at least, you know, the bridge between Cincinnati and northern Kentucky before you got into Mississippi, right?
Yeah.
It is a major fucking hub for development in this country. Now it's just Cincinnati, but at the time, big-ass deal. So it makes sense. This was a big hub connecting industrialized north with developing south.
Well, at this moment, Frank's budget was pretty much limitless, you know? Honestly, the postal inspectors had a huge budget.
We've saved so much money not buying cash registers this year, Frank. You can do whatever the fuck you want.
He probably saved them a lot of money with all the fraud that was going on. Inspectors are generally good at analyzing data, analyzing anything going on with money going in and out, and they save so much money by cutting corners, finding out fraud.
Yeah, protecting their houses with ADT.
Well, we'll get into that in a minute. So,
yes.
He sent out people to watch the post offices in Marion, Ohio, and also people to watch Sam Lima's store and basically tail him everywhere.
If you see anybody with a bucket of paint, you tell me immediately. We need to put an end to this.
No more paint. We're going to the paint stores. We're going to the hardwood, the hardware stores. We're going to find them all. Well, he also sent people to watch for letters that the Black Hand was sending, right? So Frank by himself went out and befriended postmen, mail carriers, and Marion and the surrounding areas because he wanted to know everything. He wanted all the information all the time. Any little detail he could get pretty much would help him in the case to come, and he was primed to get it. Obviously, this kind of flurry of lawmen and goings-on would have whipped up the papers at some point, as they were always searching for the next story, right?
Totally.
So, for Frank to catch Lima, the investigation would have to remain secret.
Obviously, yeah.
He couldn't have the papers sitting in the paper being like, postmen looking for undercover businessmen extorting money from people. They would just leave and stop, yeah. You know, at the point, yeah. Just wait. Yeah, well, he basically called up all his journalist buddies and the big papers in the area and made a deal with them. If they would hold off posting anything in the papers until the arrest, he would give them all the information going detail by detail with all the journalists, all together, so none would get the scoop on the others. And the group of journalists happily agreed. They wanted all the detail. They didn't want anybody else scooping these stories for him so they could all release at the same time in the different states. Because he was talking to, like, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, all the big papers, you know, the Boston Globe. Anything in that time, he was talking to those journalists.
That's why he had his lead investigator watching the hutch. That's the, like, anything that lands on this hutch, you let me know.
You tell me. He now had his team together, and also the hush-hush from the papers, and so he could finally get on with his next part of the plan. With everything set up, he still had no end to get any information or even evidence besides John Emicon in some of the letters.
I've got the entire network set up for me to do some really cool shit, but I don't actually have a plan to do any cool shit at the moment.
Yeah, he's like, I gotta figure something out real quick. He's basically flying by the seat of his pants. And he's like, I don't have literally anything besides this one tiny thing that I really need, but I can't get the one other tiny thing that I need to make this all work.
That's the Frank Oldfield process right there.
That's the Frank Oldfield magic. Yes.
Right?
He made it work because luckily a letter arrived to Frank Oldfield from an inside informant that he didn't even know he had.
Oh, shit. Mom?
Yeah. It literally in the story says he didn't know that he had this informant. He just got
Francesca
a letter
Oldfield,
saying,
that's my mother.
You wouldn't believe what I learned when I was trying to buy some bananas to make some banana bread, just as your sweet, adorable wife, who you don't spend enough time with, Frankie. You don't spend enough time with her. She was asking me about my banana bread recipe, and I couldn't remember, was it baking soda or was it baking powder? So I had to go out and I had to get some baking soda and some baking powder, but mostly I had to get bananas because the last ones, you know how your father was. Your father never, he never lets me eat the bananas on time, and they always go bad, and he says, why don't you just make some banana bread about it? But then I don't have any flour at the time. So why don't you spend more time with the kids, Frankie? Yeah, you really, you need to...
And on page 14, the secrets were revealed.
The secrets were revealed. And those secrets were that Sam Lima and his associates were going to have a meeting at the fruit store, which I don't know how his mom got that information, but she did.
So while I was there and I was telling the very nice lady at the cash register, which I don't know if you heard about this, but those things don't work very well. Well, I was, as I was sitting here and she was trying to figure out how to use the cash register, I overheard something that I think might help you in your new little career that you got going on here. You know, the one your father got you? Okay, so here's the plan. And I hope you're doing better this time, okay? That last time, not going to say it was a stain on the family, but let's just say we tried to wash it out. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do is when you tell your wife the rest, oh, yeah, the information. So the plan was.
And on and on, page 30.
14 highlighters later, he was able to put together her deeply coded message.
So coded, he didn't even know it was coded. Well, this whole meeting was going to be a who's who of the Society of the Bananas. So it was time to write down license plate numbers, as we talked about in the last episode. You remember, we literally described and joked why this was a bad idea to put your store and your illegitimate and your legal business in the same spot.
Yep. Yep. Generally, terrible idea.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam Lima, for starting this. At least it's easier to catch mafia people now.
Unless you're a multi-million dollar corporation, you can't get away with that. If you're a multi-million dollar corporation, there are legal loopholes for you to get away with that. But until you get to that point, man, you just got to hold back.
Yeah. And they're not multi-million dollar yet. They're trying to get to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. They're getting there. They're getting there.
They're getting there. Yep. So on March 9th, 1909, it was time for the Society of Banana to meet, which just always sounds funny to say, the Society of Banana to meet.
Headed up by the Chiquita Banana Lady. They walked in.
They walked in together. Well, Frank and the other inspectors got to town early the day before and staked out the fruit store, right? They watched from the Pilgrim Inn, which was just across the street from the fruit store. It's the name, the Pilgrim Inn. It's also a cool name. They had also put people at the train stations, watching as the society members got off the train. And if you're wondering how they figured out who to be on the lookout for when they got off the train, right?
Yes. Yes.
Were you wondering?
Okay. No.
Well, they got the... No?
I'm picturing everything in black and white, except for the banana that all of the members have hanging out of their front, like, breast pocket. They're just like, And they all... Everything's in black and white slash, like, sepia, except for the yellow-ass banana that's just hanging out.
Only on the Society of the Banana members. Yes. That's how they found out. Well, they did get the names off the letters Sam Lima had sent out and addresses because the postal clerks set aside the letters right after Sam dropped them off at the post office because they knew that's who they were looking for. Remember when I said he went into the post offices and made friends with them?
Yeah.
He also said, if this guy comes in, set those letters aside. There's a thing I also did not mention yet that is really huge. I'm going to mention it now.
Okay.
They sold specific stamps to Sam Lima, and the stamps were only sold to him.
Oh,
they had a little red 2 inside the O on the 1900 stamp, and it was so tiny that it was very hard to see, but only the inspectors knew where it was, and Sam Lima never knew. So it was these little details, and there was a story about how the postal clerk there was just talking to Sam Lima, like, thank you so much, and she took out the stamp just when he came in.
Damn.
And then as soon as he left, she puts the stamps, that set of stamps underneath. So now they can track everything being sent by him.
That's some sneaky snail mail, man. That's some shit. But I do wonder immediately, okay, so two things, because I'm not a Frank Oldfield fan. I mean, as a character, brilliant. I love him. One of my favorite. As an individual, kind of a shitbag.
Yeah,
now,
for sure.
So Frank Oldfield, when you say making friends with folks, do you, let's put this in context. He's their boss.
Kind of.
And he's showing up. He outranks them. within the institution that
he can make them do anything he wants to.
Okay, so I want to point that out. I'm just saying, I want to point that out. And when you say stamps, was he running an illegal counterfeit program of stamps?
I mean, technically, if you look at it like that, yes.
I am. Okay, so what? Okay, so
but I think this also needs to be said. This also needs to be said. He works for the government, so anything he does is legal.
All right, Nixon.
And
so,
we're going to end it there and keep going.
Anything I do is legal.
We'll just move forward.
I got you. I got you. I just legitimacy of the state. Sorry.
Oh, it's correct. I agree. I think this is complete craziness, but
it's fucking cool. It's fucking cool. 100%.
It's a cool idea.
And I don't want to detract too much, but just
For the addresses, they got the names, and because of the postal clerks, they got the likenesses of them. They were basically like, this guy has a mustache, this guy has a mustache, this guy has a mustache.
In 1909,
this guy wears
they
a
were
suit
identifying
and has
people
a mustache.
Based off of mustache.
Yeah. And this guy had a mustache, and this guy had a suit and a mustache.
Every time. Yeah.
And so they technically really easily ID'd the people getting
off the
train. Quick,
he's running towards us with his back. Shoot him.
Yeah, quick, shoot him. He's running. But it was actually, all in all, it was a lot of great detective work to get the identification of these people.
Totally.
And to get before like photo was a real big thing. Like it was a lot of work to take a photo. And so they got all this information about them. They got the descriptions. And so the descriptions from the postal people gave them IDs so that they can see when they got off the train, knowing who was going to be there. And they got the names, too, from the postmark envelopes.
Yeah.
Which, actually, I do want to say there's a cool thing about it, is that they, up to a time, and I think it was in the 1850s, people were opening mail. Like, federal agents were opening mail, which wasn't illegal until I think it was 1850s, 1860s.
Yeah.
They stopped that because it ended up that the federal people were tampering with the mail in order to get people arrested.
Mm.
And then the federal grand juries and the government basically said that's one of the good things they did was saying you cannot tamper with mail.
Yeah.
And so eventually they made it illegal, which also helped them arrest people that were stealing mail.
Yeah.
And get another charge on them. So it was 6 and 1/2, half dozen. They're helping them, helping other people. What made this hard for detectives now is they couldn't actually open the mail and then it'd be legal to use that mail that they opened to arrest them and put
for
him in jail.
Evidence.
So like evidence. A defense attorney would tear that up.
It's unwarranted search and seizure. Like we are protected from that. That is one of our rights. It's one of our handful of rights we have. Although that's been.
And they had to make that an actual law. All this set aside, Frank took note of the people going into the fruit store at the time the meeting was supposed to start, right? So he also noticed several of them brought in cots, as if the meeting was going to last all night.
Mm.
Well, there was a hardware store across the street. He saw them walk into the hardware store, buy a cot, come out of the hardware store, walk into the fruit store. And if you don't go, that's interesting. You would not be a good detective.
I would be a terrible detective. They're like, man, there's a lot of sleepy people here.
Yeah. It must be all the potassium that they're about to eat.
It's goddamn potassium.
I don't know if that makes you sleepy or not. Well, the meeting lasted all the way until daybreak. And in the dawn hours, the members came out two by two, heading on their way. The Society of the Banana had been busy. During the meeting, the plans were made for the next round of extortion letters. They had targeted 43 new victims.
Mm.
So it's a lot of victims at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They basically did all the background work, had all the information, had their basically almost down to how much money they were making in a day.
Damn.
They were that detailed.
Damn.
So they would send out people just watching them, you know, seeing how many bushels of bananas, how many bushels of fruits would come out of there, anything that would come out of there, apples, oranges,
Tommy guns, dynamite, cherries, anything that might be suspicious.
Anything.
Guava.
Yeah. I mean, go guava. Oh, that's the most suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we noted earlier about them making stupid decisions, not disseminating between their legal and illegal business and separating them.
Yes.
They noted all of their stuff down in a ledger, in a book. They noted the victim's name, the victim's address, the amount that they owed to them, and two columns afterwards that were marked with either a nothing or an X, depending on if they responded or not to each letter that they sent.
Preferred pronouns, general food allergies, general food preferences, mother's birthday, where their mother's address is, what she prefers in types of flowers, everything noted down.
Yeah, literally. And just so detailed, too, just like in such a nice order of like, hey, if this is found.
Yeah.
This is literal the easiest evidence in the world to be like, they literally had a ledger of everything and we have all the letters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, they were about to make, if they had gotten everything together and set, $118,000. And in 1909, that's a good bit, is today's money is $3.5 million. Which their business would have been millionaires, and they could have affected government.
Yep. Hell yeah.
Well, as you remember from last episode, John Amacon was sent a letter to get $20,000 from him.
It's
quite a bit of money, right? Well, on March 29th, 1909, Sam Lima dropped off the Black Hand extortion letters that they had talked about in the meeting into the post office. He was unaware that all the inspectors were sitting there watching him do this. They literally were just like kind of sitting off in the corner with their hands over their face, with their mustache.
Finger mustaches.
Finger mustaches.
He's just like, damn, there's a lot of French people here today. Whatever. I'm just, here's some letters. I'm just, what's up with all these French people? You don't know who they are? Oh, man, this neighborhood's going to shit. All right, well, here's my letters.
They let the French in. Well, as we had talked earlier, you know, and made a whole big deal about, it was illegal to interfere or open mail before it hit its intended recipient, right? And the only way that they could get the evidence of anything is if it actually delivered all the way to the recipients.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right on top of the stack was a letter to John Amacon. Mm-hmm. So Frank, as he got the letter, he looked at the letter before they sent it. So because the post office person, clerk, set it aside. It's like, hey, by the way, here's all these stamps that have the letter 2 in it. I saw Sam Lima get in. He's like, perfect. Easy evidence, right? Frank was ecstatic. But he also saw all the other names on the letters. So saw all the other 42 people that were getting letters, right? After the letters were delivered, detectives followed up with all the recipients, basically went wherever they were going, Pittsburgh, areas around Ohio. Some almost went as far as like California and Oregon, which is crazy.
Yeah.
They went out that far to get that stuff. Well, nobody said a word about them.
What?
Everybody that was interviewed. Because they got a letter, the police detective showed up right after the letter was delivered, and because they were all Italian Americans, they just went, I didn't get a letter.
Damn.
I didn't see anything. Because all the Italian Americans didn't trust the police, and the police didn't trust the Italian Americans, just like we said so many times, they were all dead ends.
Damn. Mm-hmm.
Nothing they could do.
Dude,
they didn't want to talk to him.
On so many, that's revealing on so many levels, though. Because it's not just not trusting the police and shit. It's also just like getting one of those letters meant so much. Because like you had to, so like think about it from their point of view. You got one of these letters, direct threat to you, right? And this police force, which doesn't represent you, ignores you, and actively will do things like the New Orleans roundup, where they will just go in and beat the fucking shit out of and arrest anybody who's Italian, right? In these neighborhoods where people have been segregated to. They're coming at you, and now you have to trust these bumbling fucking idiots who can't even fucking speak to you, right?
Yep.
You have to trust them to follow up with whatever their plans are against the Black Hand Society, quicker than the Black Hand Society will get to you, which, by the way, this is all on the basis of they already have your fucking address. Right?
There's nowhere they're getting to protect you.
Do you think this institution, the police that are showing up, are going to get to you and protect you faster, then the Black Hand will get to you and your family.
Nope.
Yeah. I wouldn't say
only
shit either,
dude. Only takes probably 2 minutes for them to come in and kill you.
No, and like...
You know, maybe less.
And like, there's got to be rumors already about these tactics because, like, they help with the overall terrorization of, like, these communities where you were saying one person gets in a town. There's already fucking people from the Black Hand Society in the town watching the reaction and listening to word on the street. So, like, there's a damn good chance the Black Hand Society is sitting across the fucking street when the inspector shows up, watching the inspector go up, and literally they're just in the background wagging their finger like, don't you fucking do it. Don't fucking say a word.
and that did happen.
That did happen, actually.
You're right. Because the Black Hand Society would be there after the day after the detective came up, and they're just like,
how'd that go?
I know you didn't say anything, but just remember, we're here.
Yeah.
You know?
We're
and
glad
like, so
you
they
didn't
already had that intimidation. You're right. Yeah. Glad you didn't say anything. And they're like, how did you know? It's like, well, you're just sitting across the street watching them talk to you.
But, like, at this time, too, you have to be thinking, like, how do you not know that the person showing up saying they're a detective isn't also a member of the Black Hand Society?
You can't. Yeah, you can't. He could just have a badge. Or he could even have a badge and, being part of the Black Hand Society because they could be paid off. Who knows? They don't know the stretch. Nobody at this point knows the stretch of how big that this, in quotations, Black Hand Society is because... The papers at the point, they have like had some people saying there's extortion stuff, just not in this big case. You know, in other areas, there's people saying there's extortion letters happening, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guarantee you that you're like your cousin in Pittsburgh and like your niece in fucking Sarasota or like Naples specifically, like, you know, like I guarantee you that like they talked about how the Black Hand Society came into their town, the type of shit that went around with it. None of this shit's being reported into the news in any substantial fucking way.
Uh-uh.
You just know that when it happens, it fucking happens and anything's possible. And so, like, paranoia level through the fucking roof at this point.
Yeah. And what's crazy, too, is it also worked in the reverse way.
Mm.
Because the Black Hand Society, the Society of the Bananas, they weren't getting any information back that they were looking into the Society of the Banana because nobody was talking back to them because the community was so insular. You know, well, they weren't talking back to him, obviously, but...
Well, there was still that one Amish guy that was just getting all this money in the middle of Pennsylvania that was just confused as fuck. That nobody was able to write a letter back to him.
I built the post office, but I can't read the letter.
Well, you can't. No, you couldn't even paint it.
Why are you arresting me for painting the post office?
You charged us double, Jebediah.
We got you.
Well, of course, John Amacon received his letter and brought it directly to Frank, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, to be fair, this was only one letter and really wanted to... It wouldn't be enough to put Sam Lima away, right? So all the letters that Amacon had got was only one victim, right? And so Frank was like... I really want to go to the DA, so I'm just going to do it. I don't think I have enough to go to the DA to get them to start pressing charges, but I'm going to do it anyways. And so he tried to press the DA of Ohio and laid out all of his notes and the criminal trial basically that had built up against Sam Lima and all the other members. Well, the DA was just like, hey, you don't have enough evidence to prosecute. And especially because the money that if you say that they're making the money that you say they're making, they could spend on the highest priced lawyer to get out of this, and they could wreck our careers and also end our lives. We could basically be killed.
They were almost at the point of becoming an institutionalized crime.
Yep.
Like, I really want to put that in perspective here. Again, if you become a multi-billion dollar industry, there are laws to protect your illegality. In this country, especially at this fucking time. God damn, especially at this time. They will write you into Congress to get you a spot. Like, they were that fucking close to being like, we're untouchable because we make so much fucking money, and I guarantee you laws would have been formed around them.
Yep. This is literally the prequel to the Mafia.
Yeah.
This is the prequel. Like, this is them. This is how it became what it became. You know, they came over from Italy, from Sicily, a lot of them. And just sat there, built these family criminal empires, And then slowly, slowly, they grouped together and formed these huge groups. After some of them got arrested, the ones that were arrested were kind of picked off and then eventually brought back into it, which we'll go back into it later at the end. But, you know, Frank had the paper trail evidence, but he couldn't get any more witnesses. And again, I can't harp on this enough, but detectives couldn't get any information out of anybody that received the letters because they just didn't want to talk to him. So Frank knew of two people who could help him out in this situation. Literally only two in the whole of the United States at this time. The first was working for a New York detective office, but sadly, they had shuttered due to budget cuts. And well, also people were murdered by criminals in that office, so
that'll
they kind of were
it.
Like, hey, we should cut this down.
They were shuttered due to dynamite flying in through their shutters.
Yeah, by a lot of mob criminals, which is you know, kind of what happened later in the 1940s,
who keeps throwing bananas
40s, 50s,
in here? Oh,
60s and 70s. Dynamite bananas. Well, there was now only one man for the job that he could think of. That was the Raven, Francis Demio. And
hold
he
up.
Flew in.
I don't know why a Raven sounds like that.
Now, after the years of his undercover prison stint, he was made the superintendent of the Pittsburgh headquarters for the Pinkertons. He was pretty much the most sought-after detective of the country. But, funnily enough, he still was incognito. He was just known in the detective circles, which is kind of cool, which is great. Because remember how we talked about before that he was just markedly average looking.
Yeah.
He could blend in.
Except for the eagle tattoo on his face.
Except for the eagle tattoo on his face. Yeah. With the stars and the American flag on his back.
Yes.
Now, Frank took the train up to meet with Demio because he really, really needed him. It was actually free for him because he flashed his badge, and he gets free rides for flashing his postal inspector badge.
Yeah. Oh, your kid's aren't here with you today. That's strange. You doing all right? You must be on vacation.
He's like, I'm always on vacation. Frank went through all the notes and details of the case with Demio, right? Pretty much like a nervous schoolboy chattering and monologuing all the way through.
Yeah.
Literally. And after Frank had stopped, finally, Francis Demio took a beat and calmly said, not a problem.
Okay, so this next piece of evidence is the one submitted by my mother. So apparently, on October 8th, 1909,
I was sitting inside of the cafeteria and I was thinking about what's the difference between half and half and full. I've never actually seen full and I'm wondering what full would look like. So as I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, and I call over the waitress, very nice girl. Honestly, you should talk to her sometime. I know things are doing well with you and your wife, which you should spend more time with her. So I called her over to the table and I said, hey, so I know that this is half and half and I'm wondering, you know, I'm gonna drop the line. Is it half off? Anyways, so I ask her, I says, how are you doing today, Mabel? Mabel says, I'm doing fine. I said, that's fantastic. So I have this boy, Frank, and we've been watching this fruit stand, you know, and it's not just for our health. Although a doctor does say we need to eat more bananas. Have you ever heard of the bananas? Really, I think secretly behind all this, his mom was the one uncovering everything.
What's so funny too, yeah, it's just like dad helped him get the job, and then his mom was the one who was actually the detective.
Dude.
They're just like literally pushing him to the top. Like, I hope to God he finally, that boy finally got a job.
I mean, think about it. His mom had to, A, not only raise him, that had to have been a fucking feat, but B, deal with her husband who's like making deals with and doing all this high powered fucking shit all across the fucking country at the time like that. She had to pull all these fucking people together and keep the family together. You know, she was the fucking bedrock behind all this. Guaranteed.
Oh, she was, yeah.
Guaranteed.
She kept it together. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after recruiting Demio, right, this was the perfect time to recruit him because, like, maybe a couple months before this, Demio had cultivated a friendship with a young kid named Orozio Perabelli, who was just 19 years old, right?
Okay.
And just like the guy in the jail in New Orleans, Manuel Polizzi, Orezio was forced into the Black Hand Society and was put down by everyone else.
Aww.
Just like Polizzi. He knew how to pick these guys out.
Mm.
He was so good at befriending them and then using them, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why they call him the Raven. That's my what a raven sound. Sounds like.
That's my raven that's sound eagle. Every time.
Or a hawk. Yeah. Well, Aurizio became the man on the inside, and the side of the banana made him a hitman of sorts, right? Aurizio was to kill whoever didn't pay the extortion money. So basically, letters sent out, they send it to the victim, and they go, okay, we're not paying this, blah, blah, blah. Lima was like, you're going to kill that guy. And he had to go do it.
Damn.
Or they would have killed him.
Yeah.
Well, I honestly think the message and the talking between Demio and Oldfield and the young kid kind of went a little bit more like this.
Don't worry your kitty little head about this. We'll kill anyone that gets in the way of you being killed. And that's the Frank Oldfield promise.
Who the fuck is Frank Oldfield?
You haven't heard about Frank Oldfield? He's the number one undercover cop in this country. And he ain't even a cop. He's going undercover as cops. He's actually a postal inspector. The guy's my fucking hero. And that's coming from the Raven.
But they will kill me.
Yeah, and I told you, we'll protect you from being killed by anybody before we get a chance to kill you.
That doesn't make sense. But
that's okay, we got
I'll
you.
I'll help you.
All right.
Okay. Well, Aurizio basically had no choice. You know, he was in between a rock and a hard place. He was either going to be killed by the Society of the Banana, or he was going to be thrown in jail by freaking Demio.
He was
or killed,
gonna,
either or.
He was going to be killed by a banana or a postal inspector.
Yeah, like he couldn't do anything else. I mean, that's in between a banana and an inspector.
When you wake up one day and realize that your life is so benign, the two greatest threats to your life are bananas and the post office. One of those two are going to take
my
you
God.
Home.
In the 1900s, that meant a lot more than it would today.
It's like, we all know that like back in the day, so many simple things, you know, now simple things could have killed you. But I never expected, looking back in time, that it was between letters from the post office and bananas. Those were my options.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Different times. The world's really been tamed.
Different times. The world's changed. So, obviously, he agreed to help Demio and Oldfield because he really had no choice, honestly. And because he was forced into this. Like, he didn't even want to be part of the Black Hand Society or the Society of Bananas.
I just want to work in the mines.
Something I didn't mention, I talked to Gil about earlier, too, is that he actually worked in the mines.
Oh,
he
Jesus.
Was found by Demio in the mines. Like, he was just a miner.
What the fuck was Demio doing in the mines?
You remember when I said that he worked for the mining companies for the Pinkertons in the first episode?
Oh, yeah. He was probably there busting up unions.
Actually, for this part of it, he was busting up mobs in the mines that were stealing money from the workers. And this kid was one of the people that was getting money stolen from him. So he befriended them because they were beating up on him. They were like, now you're, you know, stealing money from him. And he did the same thing he did with the New Orleans guy in jail, just like I said earlier. And he befriended him and he waited, just like a good spy. He waited until the time was right when he could finally use him and then said, perfect timing.
Yeah.
I know a perfect person. And
yeah.
Oldfield basically was like, cool, there's only one person. I don't really have to pick anybody, so this makes my choices easier. I just hire the one guy who can do this job very well and is the only guy to do this job. So
yeah.
With the information coming in about all the death threats and orders for hits from Aurizio, Oldfield and Demio and some other inspectors went into the mayor's house super, super, super early in the morning. They roused him out of bed.
Are you here to paint my house?
We're here to help.
They got him to write a search and arrest warrants for Samuel Lee. Yeah, they're in there to help. And the mayor probably didn't even know about what was going on, to be fair.
Oh, God, I swear I'm going to pay him back. Please don't take my shit in auction. Oh, God, you're here to paint my house, aren't you? Aren't you?
No. It's okay, mayor. We're here to save you.
We're here to help you. Now they were ready and legally able to move against the society, right? So on June 8th, 1909, detectives and inspectors burst through the doors of Sam Lima's fruit shop. This is about 8 a.m., so they burst in right as soon as they opened.
I picture them, like, the doors were already wide open and facing the street, and, like, the inspectors walk up, and they're like, this won't do. And they sit there, and they, like, you know, slowly fuck around with, like, the fucking stop on the door, just kick it out of the place, and the owner's just sitting there like, what are you doing? And he just sits there, and he, like, reaches his arm on the inside, make sure to, like, turn it so it faces up so it's locked, and they both close it, test the doors real quick, and they're like, yeah, it's locked. Then they step back 5 feet and then just run towards it, just kick in the fucking door. Yeah!
Why are you doing this to me?
This is my business. Well, as soon as
the
doors were
burst open.
What the fuck am
I paying ADT for these days?
Yeah. Arigo. Well, Lima, as soon as this happened, jumped out of the back window of the shop, almost getting away. He was like, peace, I'm gone. He knew what they were there for.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he almost got away. But luckily, as he jumped out the back window of the shop, he almost got away. But foresight of the police officers and detectives was pretty damn good, because they literally had somebody waiting out the back at the back window, knowing he was going to jump out the back waiting for him.
He's just back there, just like smoking a cigarette, like, Lulu, Lulu, I want some apples, Lulu. So, oh, Jesus, and just like falls on top of him.
Yeah, got him. It was the greatest chase in the world.
They have the police, like the police van, the police wagon, just like literally parked with the doors open facing the back window. So he jumps into the back of the wagon.
They just close the door. Yeah.
Yes. But the wagon's actually a postal van.
Ooh. Oh. Damn.
Damn.
Nice. You couldn't even write it better yourself if you were a Hollywood script writer.
Couldn't have. It's impossible. Fuck couldn't you.
Yep. Well, after they caught him, they brought him back into the office, right?
Post office.
Probably with a few fresh bruises. They sat him down back in his office, the fruit store's office in the back of the place. I want to tell you, why did they do this? They literally made it so much easier to prosecute the crimes. They made Samuel Lima open up his safe that he had in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And as the safe opened, Frank Oldfield cracked the biggest smile anyone had ever seen on his face.
Oh, shit.
Bigger than when he was practicing his favorite hobby, being an auctioneer.
What did he see? What was in the safe?
As soon as they opened the safe, they opened the ledger that had all the names and the number, the freaking money, and whether they had responded to the letters or not. And he's like, God damn, this is everything I ever needed in my life. And his penis and rose.
He came 15 times that day.
I would say 43 times.
They said that his penis grew 15 times the size that it was that day.
Exactly. And after they did this, they started tearing open the walls and found all of the money that Sam Lima had hidden away and took from everybody else. So they sat him down and started interrogating him. And this really wasn't a small amount either. The whole floor was littered with money once they had finished breaking the walls. You know, this had to be really fun for Frank, because Frank Oldfield probably did something very cinematic, like in a movie, and just walking around, tapping the wall, saying, I wonder, where do you keep your money? And then randomly punching the wall. Oh, there's some. And then walking again. Wonder where the rest of it is. And then punches the wall again. And then just goes, that's some money. And then he looks at Lima and he stomps his foot on the floor and says, well, that's the Frank Oldfield stamp of approval. You're going to jail.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
He's such a dweeb.
I imagine that he did that. Well, they did interrogate Lima in his office to see if they could get a confession, because, well, a confession was as good as guilty. Right?
Yeah.
What do you know? What do you know about Gorgonzola? About Taleggio? About Parmigiano Reggiano?
Never heard of any.
What do you know about the Society of the Banana?
Never heard of it. I sell bananas. I'm a businessman.
Well, boys, case closed. This man's clearly innocent. We're heading home. Yeah.
And literally, that interrogation was all it was, because he wouldn't say anything. But I did want to mention this interrogation, because honestly, it was Lima talking to Frank Oldfield, right? And so Oldfield wasn't getting anything. He wasn't even pretending like he spoke English, right? So as soon as that happened, Demio went and moved Frank out of the way. As he was right in the face of Lima, Demio goes, I got it from here.
Frank, just calm down. Okay, Frank, you're coming in too intense. I'm the rookie here, Frank. Frank, I am the rookie here. Let me come in. Let me handle this for you, Frank. He's like, all right, Raven. If you say you got this, just calm down, Frank. I got this.
That's literally what happened, because Demio then, in quotations, encouraged Lima to find his English skills. And I love the way that they say that, because it really doesn't, it's a very nice way, I imagine, to being that he beat the shit out of him to be like, yeah, we know you speak English.
What was the episode that I was, There was, it wasn't Slivko, it wasn't Joachim Kroll, maybe it was Slivko. No, it was Pedro Lopez.
The German one.
No, it was Pedro Lopez, yeah, where like everybody was fully aware at the time that the police used, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques.
Yep.
And reading through that, it's like, y'all beat the fucking shit out of him. That's what you did.
I love the way that they describe it, not using beating them up, but enhanced interrogation techniques, helping him learn how to speak English.
He's just sitting there, he's just like, A stands for what? Apple, that's right. And B stands for, come on, you got this. Come on, you got this. What does B stand for?
It's right up there. It's right up there.
Banana. He said it. He said it. Get him. Get him.
Get him. Beat him up. Get him. He's guilty. He's guilty.
Banana foster that man's ass. Come on.
Yep. After all of this, and, you know, the interrogation, making him remember English, they handcuffed Lima and took him straight to jail. They didn't take him to the postal inspection service. They took him right to jail.
Straight to jail.
Well, about 5 o'clock rolls around. They're still in the place looking around, making sure everything's going. His brother Sebastian Lima strolls into the fruit store, who they were also looking for. And he's just like looking around, and they're like, you're under arrest.
What?
What'd I do?
Okay.
Okay. Oh, God. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, because Demio was there, it was easy for them to translate that he was under arrest.
Smash his head on the table.
That translates to you're under arrest.
Yeah.
Well, that night after the arrest, Frank finally let the press in on all the secrets of the investigation. He let loose on everything that went on and how awesome his strategy was. He made mention of Demio, but of course took all of the credit. Well, most all of the credit. He still did give credit to his other inspector buddies that he liked.
And there was an Italian guy there. But anyways, I was super cool. I was sitting in the back waiting with my trunk open, which everybody thought that that was an accident. No, it was on purpose. So when he busted through the window.
Yeah, he went on and on about the details.
I laid
to the
a
paper.
Trap of stamps I had already pre-licked in the seat. So when he landed, stuck there, ready to go. You know where I mailed him? Straight to jail.
That's awesome. Well, in the next few days, Demio and Oldfield would arrest all of the other members of the society, right? So not all of them, but most all of them.
Yeah.
The Vaccaro brothers.
Okay.
Salvatore Lima, who is the father.
Yeah.
Saverio Ventola, Francesco Spadaro, Vincenzo Rigo, Orazio Ronfola, and Peppino Galbo.
Fucking dope name.
Like his name.
I like Peppino.
Yeah, yeah. The last on the Oldfields list to arrest was, of course, the old man himself, who was put out to pasture, Salvatore Arrigo, the original old leader of the society. He was hidden for a few months after everybody else was arrested, and was noted that they probably would not have found him if not for his penchant for candies, wine, and flowers. They chased down the address for these found out that an Italian restaurant was sending things to that address as well. So Salvatore was literally brought down by the things that he was gorging himself with while he was in his retirement. Pasta, ladies, and wine. When the press asked Frank Oldfield about how they caught Arrigo, Frank responded by saying,
the old man was betrayed into our hands by his preference for macaroni, spaghetti, and ravioli. He and his two Italian companions just finished eating a lot of macaroni when we pounced upon them. Baskets full of macaroni, spaghetti, Roma cheese, vermouth, and Italian wines were in the cabin for a feast of some kind, but we spoiled that.
He literally had to have a pun at the end of his thing saying how he caught them. We spoiled it.
We spoiled that. That wine turned to vinegar in our hands. We got him.
So they finally got Arrigo after a couple of months, and because of the letters
at
the things that were being sent to him. at dinner. Yeah, as we joked about in the second episode, is that he literally retired into what he's doing.
He was just
and
chilling.
He didn't stop, even though he was on the run.
I mean, would you?
No, he probably knew he was going to be caught eventually.
I would have a great time.
Yeah. Yep. He just wanted to live it up.
Yeah.
Well, with all the evidence, witnesses, and now all of the criminals in jail and awaiting trial, Oldfield knew it was literally still going to be an uphill battle to get them all convicted. The society had an overpriced lawyer, something similar to Johnny Cochran representing O.J. Simpson in the famous "If the glove does not fit, you must acquit" trial. Well, on January 10th, 1910, the opening argument started, and immediately the defense attorney argued to throw out the indictments of the prisoners. He said, "This is nonsense. The mere writing of a letter in no way constitutes collusion or conspiracy.
Ooh.
These letters are purely innocent correspondence among businessmen. We respectfully ask the court to throw out this indictment and release the prisoners."
Damn.
The motion was sustained, and the 14 of the counts were waived. There was only one count that they said that they were going to try all of these men for. So the court date was moved 18 days later.
Okay. It's an odd number, but yeah.
Well, yeah, it was a weird number. I don't know why 18 days later came up, but
anyways.
Maybe it's just time to get some more
holiday
stuff
season
together. I don't
know.
Well, after all this time and all the evidence Oldfield and Demio had gathered, it all looked like it was about to go for nothing. So literally, right after that piece, Oldfield again recruited the A-team.
Yeah.
Which included Demio.
Obviously.
Now, even though the society was in jail, victims were still not celebrating or even coming forward to testify yet because they were still scared that they were going to be murdered. Even though these people were in jail, it's still the leaders.
Also, though, like, you have to think, too, this is an old school tactic from Italy, right? From Sicily, right? What's to tell folks like Italian-Americans now? What's to tell them that these are all the members of the Black Hand Society, right? Because it's a tactic. It's not an actual organization. So
yeah,
this
right?
Is a
it's not an organization.
So what's to tell folks that received a letter? How do they fucking know that these handful of folks engaging in a tactic, are linked to these folks that are on trial? Like, you don't fucking know. It's like somebody who's in jail for, like, stealing a car. That doesn't automatically make you think, huh, I don't have to lock my car anymore because the one person that was in charge of stealing cars is on trial and they're locked. You don't think that. You're like, no, there's still other folks out here stealing cars. There's still other folks out here engaging in Black Hand letters.
Yeah, and in the paper, it was made to be and look like this was a huge organization so that they would get the maximum jail time for all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, the sensationalism was big and they were just... People are getting fed with this, like, well, maybe the people are still out there, which there were. Like, there was still society members out there that weren't arrested that had nothing against them. They were just the low-line people, and they could have been easily directed from jail, from Lima, them being in jail, being like, hey, go kill those people, just like they do nowadays.
And I guarantee you, the Society of the Banana is not the only society engaging in Black Hand tactics. I guarantee you they're not the only motherfuckers out there. And, like, they're not, again, one Amish guy is being framed for all this in the hypothetical world that I created. So, you know, but you don't, it's not like, you know, like, what's his name? It's not like Lima is like, with love, Lima, at the end of every fucking letter. So then they see Lima on trial and they're like, oh God, it's him. They don't know who.
Yeah, no, they don't. The only one that did was John Amicon.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only one that knew that this was the exact person they were looking for because he had literally pointed him out to Frank Oldfield, was like, that's the guy. I'm pretty damn sure that that's the guy you need to look into. Found out, obviously, he was right. So, and it was weird because they actually found that all the letters were addressed to John Amishcon, which was the guy's name.
No, you're making that up.
I am making that.
Okay, goddamn, you always get me with that shit.
Which would be really funny.
Damn it. It's just like one person out there with just like a Rolls Royce design, like horse and buggy, just like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rumspringer for life, let's go.
Literally, yeah.
Oh, my God. That probably happened.
Well, I hope so.
Well, he...
If it's a world I want to live in, it did.
Yeah. Well, Demio and Frank Oldfield were like, we got to go back out. We got to get some more people. We got to get some more people testifying. This one guy isn't going to do it. So Demio convinced 20 of the recipients of the letters to come forward and testify. 20 out of the 43, right?
Okay.
So he had the, well, 20 plus one because they had Amicon still.
Yeah.
So 21 out of the 43. Even though they were about to get rid of the Nusis, who had plagued them for years and even terrified them, the victims were still not super excited to testify. They were kind of just like, we're not really happy about doing this, but we will do this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, somebody that speaks our language is actually coming and talking to us. He's actually making sense about why we should throw these people in jail and what it could mean if we don't put these people in jail. It kind of helped that Demio was there. I mean, it literally was
obviously
the only reason. Yeah, only reason that this happened. Well, they just got the leaders off the street, right? So just like we had said, every single member of the society was not arrested. There were still people in the streets that could still rough them up, still kill them. And Lima could still order somebody from jail, like we had just said.
Uh-huh.
Well, with their newfound witnesses, Oldfield was now confident he could get them thrown in jail for good. Like, get a guilty verdict, and he's done. On January 19th, 1910, so right after, you know, Christmas time, and, you know, it kind of got through the holidays, the first witness was called to the stand. And Gil, can you guess who the first witness was?
Frank Oldfield's mom.
Close.
Oh, okay.
Relatively close.
Oh, relatively close, you say. Frank Oldfield's dad.
Who was coming in to save the day again?
A little closer.
Fine, I'll talk to the fucking judge. Jesus. You know, a key part of the word retired is the word tired. I am retired. Following up with you, Frank, everywhere. I really wish you could just put you on your own fucking suspenders these days.
Well, actually, he did put on his own suspenders.
All right.
Frank Oldfield came strutting and smirking, grinning from ear to ear into that courtroom, just like, swinging his arms back and forth, gets up there, and he, who was a crazy guy in a lot of ways, against his normal nature, was calm, cooled, collected, and he detailed the whole investigation detail by detail.
He did his job, is what you're telling.
Literally.
He, for once in his life, he did his fucking job, which was not punch walls, smash people's heads into tables, fight random people on the street, fence people's shit. He actually walked into court and represented his position properly.
He was a little stoked.
Yeah, a little. He was super stoked.
It was a little bit weird when, like, the Stone Cold Steve Austin intro music from WWF, like, started blasting when he walked into the courtroom, where it was like, brr. Fireworks going up. Frank Oldfield just smashing two fucking, like, Budweiser cans in the air and just throwing them into the fucking crowd.
It's funny. He did mix The Rock with Stone Cold Steve Austin because the first part of it was like, can you smell what Frank Oldfield's cooking?
I hope it's that banana bread I sent him a recipe for. You know, his wife really needs to learn how to make that.
And what is funny, actually, he did not spend the whole year that he was, he did not go see his family. And so you're actually right about talking that he didn't. The only time he went to see his family was for Christmas after he had arrested the Black Hand Society members, Side of Banana, and the trial. So for Christmas that year in 1909, he went to see them for like 2 weeks and then was like, nah, I gotta go.
I'm your present. You're welcome. Yeah.
And that's what he said. That's what he told his
Jesus
kids.
Jesus Christ.
In the story, they actually made a specific point for one reason or not to say what his son wrote for Christmas. And it was just like, I want a bike and I want daddy to be home. The second part wasn't actually there because they didn't really care if he was home or not.
I don't know what to do with this gun that he gave me.
You know, he couldn't hold back from being a little bit cinematic. After he had given his long and drawn out testimony, he pulled from his vest pocket a small metal cap and held it up for the audience to see. He then exclaimed,
"This tiny instrument of terror is a fulminating cap used to set off a giant, fucking huge, dynamite explosion. It was recovered from an iron box." You know about my history with ironworks. All right, we got an issue already. "From an iron box in the home of Mr. Salvatore Lima of Marion, Ohio, 43287 Oakster Street, 2 E's. You need to spell the street with S-T-R. We're real sticklers about that, all right? Some of us are not for the abbreviation movement that's taking place in this country, all right? The S-T and the A-V-E and the R-D with the little periods at the end. What are you, women? All right? We're not here for periods, okay? We fill it out in full, okay? And that's how I learned to make banana bread."
You can actually find the recipe for Frank Oldfield's banana bread on blackcatreport.com. We'll be releasing a new line of banana bread.
19 and a half pages for 3 ingredients.
And you have to connect the pages. Yeah, the ingredients are in the 19 and a half pages.
We abuse our listeners with forcing them to research everything. They should know that by now.
Yes. Yeah. Well, after he gave his long and dynamite speech and his quote about the freaking dynamite giant dynamite explosion that recovered from an iron box.
"We're not switching to abbreviations for roads."
Yeah. He was mad about that.
Real pissed.
But the next witness after Oldfield was the young kid, Barabelli, who had surprised everyone in the courtroom because literally no one knew who the fuck this kid was. They're like, "Why are they strolling this kid in there?" And as soon as he, like, everyone's like, "Who is this kid?
Who the fuck is this kid?"
Even freaking Lima didn't even know who he was. Mm-hmm. None of the society that in knew who he was because he was just a low-level hitman. You know,
he wasn't a salesman.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
potassium pusher, if you will.
Aurizio Parabelli said that the Society of the Banana had initiated him into the society.
"They jumped me in. You don't want to know what they did with the bananas to get me into the club. Oh, God, the amount of bananas they stuck between my toes. Do you know what that feels like? Peels off, squeezing between the toes.
Ew.
Salvador, he cut the little brown in, just the little tip off the banana. He stuck it up to my toe when he looked me in the eyes and he said, 'This is what it feels like to get on the inside.' And then he squeezed all them little seeds going between my toes, squinting out like my feet were toothpaste bottles. Please put these men in jail. Stop this crime."
Well, after they initiated him in,
then he made bread.
And they put the bananas.
With the
and they served the bread that they put in his toes.
Made me eat it. It's the weirdest shit I've ever been. And I've been to Cincinnati.
After they initiated him into the banana, they said, "You have to eat this bread. And if you don't do what we say, we'll kill you."
I've been trying to die this whole time.
I need to die.
Poor child.
Well, then after Parabelli said that, the prosecutor asked him in such a movie-like thing, you know, mm-hmm. just every time you see it in a courtroom, "Do you see any of those 9 men in the courtroom?" And he said, "Yes." And then pointed to all the members of the society
Damn.
Sitting in the courtroom.
Damn.
And they're like, the courtroom gasped. Well, I actually think that's what they do in the movies, always happens. So I just imagine that's what happened here. And I cannot imagine the look on Samuel Lima's face being like, "Who the fuck is this kid?" Being like, "Who even is this guy? I don't even know him.
That with a banana. What the fuck's wrong with this little kid?"
Hey, Tony, you weren't supposed to do that with the banana. Nah.
I fucking literally never did that with a banana. I don't even like bananas. What the fuck?
We only sell bananas and banana-related accessories.
Who the fuck? It was a joke the whole time. The whole point was I hated bananas. Why are they taking this so seriously?
I don't get this. I'm a legitimate businessman.
They don't even grow in the Mediterranean. What's going on here?
Yeah, I never got... I don't know why they sold bananas, but I guess they just found a niche product that was very good at the time. And
truth.
Yeah,
well, banana republics were
capitalism.
There.
After the arguments were sewn up on both sides, right, it was exactly 11 days after starting the trial. The verdicts were read. Three of the defendants were granted a new trial, as they did not have any solid evidence against them. I do also want to say, the beforehand, before I mention this part, that all of them were tried together.
Okay.
And at the beginning, the defendant's attorney tried to get them all tried separately because he believed it was a better idea because they wouldn't have any connections between all of them because
The odds of, because like when you're doing it all together, you have to present evidence that locks them all up at once. And if any of it doesn't show, and this is before RICO Act, like this is before you could just be like, no, I just have to prove they're a unit. And then I have to show that as a unit, as a group, as an organization, they committed a crime, which is what RICO eventually became. This is before that. So you got to show all of them were up to some nefarious shit, or else they all walk.
Yep. Well, and which was weird here is that they gave three of the defendants a new trial. Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily say they weren't guilty, but because it was the judge's decision, basically. Yeah. It was like, hey, I know you're guilty, and they're also, you know, Italian, so they're not getting away with it, with anything.
Yeah.
So the defendants were granted a new trial, three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Two of those defendants were guilty in the next trial, so one did get off, actually, which is kind of fun. Well,
the banana sales.
The next people, Antonio Vicario, Collegoro Vicario, Francesco Spadaro, Severio Ventola, and Salvatore Demma were given 2 years in jail. So not that much, right?
Not that much at all. Yeah.
No. Salvatore Arrigo, Peppino Galbo were both given 4 years in jail. And Mr. Samuel Lima was given 10 years in jail. The highest maximum.
These are all reasonable sentences.
Man, do you remember?
You have to think about, though, that they weren't proven guilty of murdering anybody.
Yeah, but I just like, man, back in the day when like you could do things like counterfeiting and just be out in a couple months.
Yeah.
Like, what has happened? Like, oh, never mind. The institutionalization of it. Sorry, my bad. I forgot it became an industrial complex.
It was cheaper to get people out of jail than it was to keep people in jail at this time.
They
didn't want people in jail.
Still is, but it makes a lot of people a lot of money to keep people in jail these days.
Yes.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, they were just like, 10 years is a long time. And at this time still, they had the predilection that it was... that people should still be free, and the one idea to still be free from jail and not be in a prison is an idea that the United States was part of. Like you weren't if you escape prison, you weren't adding any extra time on your sentence by escaping prison. Granted, they would grab you and put you back in jail because you still had to serve your normal time, but you wouldn't get an extra crime for leaving prison because that was the natural predilection of humans, which was viewed
to not want
to
be captive.
Oh my god. Novel idea. Well, and Frank Oldfield was actually exalted with the result of the trial because he got his big prize, Sam Lima, in jail for a good portion of time. And actually it was the longest that he could have been put in jail for extortion, mail fraud, stuff like that. So he was like, that's literally what I did.
Yeah.
And there was no proof that they were killing people, even though they did. They did kill people. And this time they just didn't have the evidence. Well, they had evidence, but he didn't use it. So I'm not going to tell you a little later about that.
Oh.
Well, after this, Oldfield became quite famous, and he was actually asked to investigate a lot of high profile cases in the 1910s. And eventually, in 1916, Frank Oldfield, died at the age of 49.
Damn.
So young. Yeah, really young.
Banana related?
Not even 6 years after the trial went forth.
Was it, did his kid drop the gun that he handed him? What happened?
No, he just didn't mention how he died. Just, he died young.
Died?
And he never got to tell his father, thank you for everything you've done for me.
I don't think he would have.
He wouldn't have, because he didn't in the 49 years of his life.
Yeah, he had this whole time to say thanks. I'm sorry. Like when his dad broke in and he removed the word removed. You know, he's had plenty of chances to say thanks, Pops.
To say thank you.
Yeah.
Well, after he died, right, his wife, Margaret, was left with his belongings. And so, you know, after he died, she's like, I have to go through the trunks that his stuff is. And so there were seven
thousands
trunks from the trial.
Yeah.
Yeah. From the trial. She found that he had never unpacked the guns, stilettos, and the knives that were literally covered in dried blood of the victims from the trial.
He was such a bad investigator.
It was so funny that he never unpacked this. And he could have used these things in the trial, but didn't.
What do you mean? It says right here in the book. Look at that. It's stamped. What else do you need?
Yeah, it's stamped. That's all that's in there.
What do you need?
That's how Frank Oldfield ended up.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Demio actually had a good life because he ended up retiring from the Pinkerton agency, then starting his own detective agency in Philadelphia.
Mm.
And he died at the ripe old age of 94 in 1958. So he lived a long time.
Damn.
Well, that's our two police officers, our two detectives from this story. Well, what became of Sam Lima, you asked?
I was wondering.
Are you asking?
I was wondering, yeah.
Well, he got through his jail sentence and was released in 1918. He only served 8 years.
Hold on, what year did Frank Oldfield die?
Frank Oldfield died in 1916.
Okay. Okay, so 1918.
Yep, Sam Lima gets out of jail in 1918, only serving 8 years, right? He was released on parole because his nephew took him and said, I've got a job for him. Sam Lima and his nephew ended up moving to San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And his nephew ended up being the leader of the San Francisco Mafia.
Oh, shit.
And damn. Sam Lima continued his murderous and strong arm ways all the way until he died in 1965.
I've always said.
That's not all.
Oh.
After he died.
Okay.
87 cars slowly drove in a procession down the small streets of San Francisco. One car for every year of Sam Lima's life.
Whoa.
And they say crime doesn't pay.
It does really well. Can make you the president.
And that's where we'll end our series on the Black Hand Society and Frank Oldfield and Francis Demio. This week, we'd like to give shout-outs, and the one shout-out I especially want to give is to my mom,
aww,
who gave me a lot of the inside information on the Black Hand Society, in quotations, and my family's connection to it.
Thank you, Joey's mom, for always being the best.
Yep, and I want to say thanks to my dad as well for giving me the love of history, and as me and Gil like to say, all of its oddities and stories.
Yeah.
Because this is just an interesting story.
This world didn't get as weird as it is because history is normal.
And we love to find the funniness in it. As much as there's dark sides, there's always comedic sides.
And
so,
and I want to throw out there too, if I can hop in here. Hello to all of you new subscribers that we've been seeing coming in, specifically on platforms like Spotify and on iTunes. Hi. Welcome to our weird little family.
Hello.
Somebody... And I can only imagine it was the French. So if you're not French, this is your call to arms. Somebody gave us a negative review on Spotify. And what I'm going to ask this week, if you've made it this far through a three-part series, please, on Spotify, go up, and if you would, give us a five-star review. if you've listened to our episodes, somebody knocked our rating down. And I can only imagine it was the Society of the Banana. And we are here to take them down, Oldfield style. That's an Oldfield promise. So if you can, please hop up on there, click the little star rating, click 5 stars, click submit. And if you don't want to give us 5 stars, the past 10 seconds didn't happen. Don't even think about this. You're going on with your life. You're happy. Everything is fine. And, y'all are the shit. Thank you for existing. You're the best. We love you. And bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening to the Black Cat Report in episode 90. Damn. Hope we don't get kidnapped for all this history on the Black Hand Society. Well, please follow us on Instagram and TikTok for all news and updates on BCR. Also, don't forget to like, review, and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you on the other side.